What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. Thank you all for your patience. We were dealing with some weather-related complications, but I'm so happy to be with you here tonight. We have a really great show for you. We have two very important segments that we're going to be doing on tonight's show. The first one is about Israel's attack on the medical system of Gaza and of Palestine in general, and its kidnapping of a doctor who is being held right now as we speak. And then we will be talking about the MAGA civil war over visas and immigration and nativism and Bannon versus Elon Musk. So very excited about both of those. And we, as always, ask you to please like the stream, give it a thumbs up. That's always really important. And also subscribe if you haven't already subscribed. That helps grow our numbers and the reach of the show so that we can have people tuning in to hear about these really important stories. And also, if you can support us at Patreon, we would love that. Patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's Patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you get to make this show happen. We literally couldn't do it without your support. And if you can swing $5 a month, you get extended interviews and bonus interviews. So we're so thankful to everyone who's already a member, and we are hoping that more people will become members. So without any further ado, I'm going to bring on our first two guests. Really honored to be speaking to them. Dr. Thayer Ahmad is a board-certified emergency medicine physician and a board member of the Palestinian American Medical Association. He's traveled to Gaza on several medical missions and recently spent 3 weeks volunteering in Al Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Since returning, he has spoken out about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and the need for humanitarian aid and services to reach the people. He is an assistant clinical professor at the University of Illinois Chicago and the global health director for his emergency department. He also walked away from Joe Biden, which is another great accomplishment we can ask him about. Dr. Ben Thompson is a renowned public health expert, nephrologist, and general internal medicine doctor, an award-winning educator, and global humanitarian physician. His efforts have markedly improved healthcare in indigenous communities in Ontario and globally in places including Uganda and in Gaza through initiatives like the Keys of Health Fellowship and Empower Gaza. Dr. Thompson envisions a world where resilient, compassionate healthcare is accessible to all communities globally. And I should add, he was suspended for speaking out about what was happening in Gaza. So let me please welcome to the virtual stage Dr. Thompson and Dr. Ahmad. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the show.
Oh, thank you. So I should have added to the bio, also impeccable taste. So please share with us what brought you to Gaza in the first place and the kind of work that you have been doing there.
Well, I mean, I can start because I'm a Palestinian American. And so, you know, my family's from a suburb of Jerusalem, but our last name suggests that we probably 150 years ago were in Gaza. And so for a very long time, I've been involved in global health and humanitarian relief. But something that I think is really tragic about the story of Palestine is that my grandparents, all of whom are not alive anymore, have never been to Gaza. They've only ever been in the West Bank and Jerusalem. And so many people in Gaza have never been to the West Bank. So many people in Gaza have never been to Jerusalem. And so this is kind of the Bantustan life that we sort of live. And so the opportunity when I became a healthcare worker to actually be able to visit Palestine and help work on healthcare infrastructure and sustainability and professional development. Once those doors to Gaza that were so tightly shut for so long slightly opened for humanitarian relief, I had to take that opportunity and have been doing it since 2009. And so for me, it's a very, it's an obligation, it's a duty that was instilled in me from a very early, early age.
You know, in 2013, the attacks on Gaza from 2012 essentially had decimated healthcare. Much of the civilian infrastructure was also destroyed. And there was a big call to the international community, the healthcare community, to get involved, to do needs assessments, to establish where investments should go. As part of that, there was a call out to see if any kidney doctors were willing to come to Gaza to do an assessment. And I didn't know anything about the occupied territories at that time, but it would have been impossible to go and only go once. Recognizing that I'm incredibly fortunate, I can actually go to the West Bank and Gaza, which is almost impossible for any Palestinian person to do. And I was able to go recognize that the report that I provided to the WHO and to the health authorities after I left with 60 recommendations essentially did nothing. It accomplished nothing. And really what was accomplished was going back multiple times, teaching in the medical school every year, setting up a program to advance training within the occupied territories of Palestine. So I've been going a couple times a year since 2013 to do that, in conjunction with some other work that I've done in some other humanitarian areas. But there's a special place in my heart for Gaza and West Bank, in large part because I know that it's an area that has largely been neglected and not talked about. And especially over the last 450 plus days of genocide, I've felt so obligated to speak up about an area that's been historically neglected.
And both of you have been actively calling for the release of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who was kidnapped by Israel. I want to ask both of you about this man, this doctor, but I want to start by asking you, Sayer, because you're actually someone who met him and has spoken to him. So tell us who he is, and then we're going to talk about what happened to him.
Yeah, Dr. Hussam is a brilliant pediatrician, and he's somebody who Kamal Adwan Hospital 5 or 6 years ago didn't look anything like it currently looks right now. He was somebody who studied in Kazakhstan, got married in Kazakhstan, had 6 children, and decided to take his training and come back to Gaza and support his local community. And, you know, Kamal Adwan Hospital is nestled in the north. It's right next to that Jabalia camp where there's so much fierce fighting happening right now and a lot of bombing by the Israelis, just totally decimating the entire area there. And Dr. Hussam forever was somebody who decided he wanted to expand the services, expand pediatric services. He wanted a newborn nursery, a NICU. So he's somebody that has really invested a lot of time and effort into Gaza and specifically its healthcare capabilities. So he's this really brilliant pediatrician, and he's somebody who I would say is really principled in his approach. And I say that just to kind of mention what's happened to him. This is not the first time that Kamal Adwan was attacked. If you, CNN even talks about a report in 2023 of December, so over a year ago, where Kamal Adwan got raided by the Israeli military and it was being shut down. And they arrested the director then. Dr. Hussam was not the director at the time. And Dr. Hussam was held and questioned, and he was released by the Israeli military. Because to nobody's surprise, he's just a healthcare worker. He's just a pediatrician. And so from that moment, he sort of took on the role of the director. He started to obviously call for international community protection for the hospital and the healthcare workers. As workers there were being killed over the last 3 months, as the hospital was being damaged, as the water supply for it and the electricity or the generator was being hit, as his son, who was in his teenage years, was killed by an Israeli missile, and he had to bury him in the courtyard of the hospital, as he himself was injured and struck in the left thigh, as somebody who watched the Israeli tanks surround the hospital and still was advocating for his patients, saying, where will they go? Where can they be treated? And so this is who Dr. Hussam is. You know, he's somebody who has had multiple opportunities to leave Gaza, to leave all of Gaza. He's a dual citizen. He could have taken his entire family to safety. And he refused to leave. And he had many opportunities to go to the south when they were really barreling down on the north. And he refused to leave. And he's somebody who sat there and would not abandon his post because he knew two things. First, he knew how important Kamel Adouane was for the people that it was serving. And second, he knew what the implications were if Kamel Adouane was shut down and all the doctors and nurses had to leave and the patients that were unable to go to other hospitals would die. Other people would leave too. And so, I mean, it's so tragic what's happened to him. And the last thing I'll say before I have, you know, kind of, I want to hear what Ben has to say, is to me what killed me, what absolutely killed me as he was walking up towards the Israeli tank, that famous video that we all had to watch, is he had to, they were talking to him as if they were friends and they shook his hand. I mean, this is the same military that killed his son 2 months ago, you know, and we had to watch him grieve on air when he was talking to all of the different international media outlets. I can't imagine what was going through his head, and I can't imagine what's happening to him right now.
Right. We actually, we have that video. Let's just take a look at that video. And there's, of course, this iconic photo that comes from that same moment where he's walking towards Israeli tanks. But let's take a look at this video.
تعال يا دكتور تعال ناخذ تريننج بالصباح صباحو كيفا
It's incredibly infuriating to watch that video for, I mean, a variety of reasons. You know, Dr. Hassam's abduction, he's one of hundreds of healthcare providers that have been abducted in what is essentially a targeted, systematic attempt to decapitate the healthcare system. You know, deliberate and targeted. It's one symptom of the genocidal intent that Israel has aimed directly at Gaza. In addition to the over 400 healthcare providers that have been abducted, over 1,000 have been killed. And, you know, we were asking what's happened, where is Dr. Hassam? And we already know, you know, many of us already know what's happening to him. We've already seen the death of dozens of abducted Palestinians in custody. Healthcare providers have been killed. They're not excluded from that group. Dr. Rantizi, Dr. Al-Borsh, who was sexually assaulted, raped repeatedly, and killed. And we all fear that something similar is happening to Dr. Hassam, and thus the urgency of advocating for his release. You know, and I think from my perspective, I remember a very good friend of mine who was killed in November of 2023, a Palestinian doctor who was a good friend of mine, Dr. Hammam Alo. And he and I had actually, in September 2023, submitted the paperwork necessary to entrench a training system for kidney medicine in Gaza. The Palestinian Medical Council was basically in the last stages of approving it. He was going to lead that program. And so October 8th, we spoke every single day since I left at the end of September. And on October 8th, he told me what was going to happen. After Gallant said they were going to shut down water, electricity, he told me what was going to happen. Hammam said genocide October 9th, 2023. Everyone in Gaza knew that that's what was going to happen next, and they predicted it, and it happened. Part of my motivation for speaking out and for the Free Dr. Hassam campaign is what Dr. Hammam told me. He explicitly said to me, if the world knew, they would make it stop. There's so many times in the last 450 plus days, I've wondered if he's right, because I've seen such inaction by our leaders, but I'm committed to still speaking out because I believe that his words eventually will become true.
Wow, that's awful. Yeah, and we have a video of doctors, including both of you, speaking out, calling for his freedom. Let's take a look at that.
Healthcare workers all over the world are calling for the release of Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, who was abducted by the Israeli forces on Friday, December 27th, over a week now.
It's really important that we free Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya.
The immediate release of Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya.
I'm calling for the immediate release of Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya.
Director of Kamel Adouane Hospital.
This is a plea for the release of Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya.
One, free Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya,
who has been wrongfully abducted by Israeli forces.
Free Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya.
His only crime was to take care of his patients.
He is a hero.
As well as the 450 other healthcare professionals that are being illegally detained by Israel.
One of the most disturbing things about this, I mean, it's hard to say what one of the most disturbing things is because so much of it is, but the fact that, I mean, it's already tragic that it happens to one person, but knowing that this is something systemic that is not just systemic, but ignored by Western media and Western politicians. In fact, I'm going to ask you more about what happened to the doctor, and then we're actually going to show someone daring to ask the Biden administration about this. But what can you tell us about what you do know about his status right now?
I mean, we know that the Physicians for Human Rights Israel took the Israeli military to court. We know that initially when they were denying that they had abducted him or that they had anybody named Hussam Abu Safiya, they later said, oh, due to human error, he is being, right now, he's currently being interrogated by the Israeli intelligence services, Shin Bet. We know that they were given, that his lawyer will be able to meet with him on January 10th, according to his family. That was what the courts had told them. And that the Israeli military was given a week to give more information about his whereabouts. And I do have to shout out like Naji Abbas, the prisoner's director at Physicians for Human Rights Israel, for really getting after this, because there are tons of prisoners in these Israeli dungeons that you just can't figure out what's going on, where they're at. Are there any charges against them? Will they be able to visit with a lawyer? And so that's the reality in terms of dealing with these abductions that are taking place. There is so much mystery. I mean, this is, it's been a miserable thing since October 7th. Long before that, we know how the Israeli systems work with respect to military courts and trying to abduct Palestinians, but it's become particularly brutal, just kind of how Ben mentioned with what's happened to Dr. Adnan Bush. We know that that's like a systemic problem that's taking place right now.
Yeah, and again, I mean, as we should just say this plainly, I mean, he essentially was raped to death. I mean, it's such a horrific thing to say and see happen. And also knowing that so much of the Western media, from, you know, Dana Bash to Jake Tapper, so many Western politicians from Kamala Harris to Hillary Clinton and people like Sheryl Sandberg have talked about this mass rape campaign that has not been proven, that has actually been debunked. And we'll get into that a bit later. But knowing that these people talk about those stories and ignore stories that have been covered by the Israeli media, I mean, there's no way they haven't heard about this. So it's just a conscious choice to say we care about, and maybe we don't even care about sexual violence. We will use sexual violence as a tool to whitewash Israel's crimes, and we will not bring up the documented sexual violence that's been covered, that Israel has admitted to, that Israeli media, ranging from not just Haaretz, but all the way to right-wing media, has reported on. And it's just awful that happens to anyone, but it's just particularly so disturbing that it's happening to people who give their lives to healing and saving the lives of others. I mean, it's just so barbaric, and like there's no bottom to this behavior. And I just want to say again, like, it's so, I'm so inspired by what both of you do and moved by it. And it's no small thing to go there and risk your lives to do what you're doing. So we know that that's what happened to Adnan Al-Bursh, that he was raped to death. We have not heard any single Western media person mention it. We also know that there were right to rape protests basically broke out after Israeli police did start detaining some soldiers. We know that a Knesset member said out loud that it was legitimate to insert sticks into people's rectums. So we know all of this, and we know that Israel can't be, well, I was going to say Israel can't be shamed, but that's not really true. They could just be defunded, but we know that the West won't do that to them. So it's just such a scary combination of realities and factors, knowing that all of this stuff has happened to people before, and obviously could be happening to this doctor as we speak. I also wanted to show, you mentioned his son. We have a picture of his son, and I want to show him, Ibrahim, who was killed. And also you, Ben, I know that you've observed, or you've met other doctors who were tortured. Can you share with us what they shared with you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know where to start, to be honest. The volume is insane, but I had done 2 months ago, I had started to do a study where I was interviewing medical students, in large part to learn what their experiences have been and how it's disrupted their medical education. Part of that interview process, I asked It was about 20 medical students at various levels of medical school at the Islamic University of Gaza and the Al-Azhar University. I asked them sort of to describe the experiences that had disrupted their medical school education. And what I heard back was absolutely horrific. One example was a male medical student in his final year of medical school. He had been abducted during one of his rotations. He was held by the Israeli military, and it was about a week before one of his final exams. And he was having, you know, anxiety about the fact that he wanted to finish this clinical rotation. So he said to one of the guards, "Look, I really don't want to be here. I want to go back to my rotation. I'm not a terrorist. I'm a medical student. I have to go. I've been dreaming my entire life to be a surgeon." And the very next thing was the soldier shot off both of his thumbs. I've seen pictures of both of his hands. This is a medical student that I taught a couple of years ago. Like, and both of his thumbs have been shot off so that he can never practice surgery again. Like, this is the depth of the depravity. Another man I saw, I was in Rafah for part of my time in March. And I was serving at a hospital that did predominantly reconstructive surgery for orthopedic injuries. And one of the men I saw, he had been working in a hospital in central Gaza as a physician. That hospital was bombarded and then subsequently invaded by Israel. He was instructed to leave. But he insisted that he had to stay to care for some of his patients who were unable to leave. He was instructed to strip at gunpoint, which he did with two of his colleagues who were similarly instructed to do the same. And he stood against a wall. When he was asked, you know, when he asked, "I'd like to use the bathroom. Can I please go to the bathroom?" He was told, "No, you have to use the bathroom where you stand." And so for what was initially hours and then was over 2 days, he stood against a wall with two of his colleagues completely naked, urinating and defecating on the floor immediately next to him. At the end of this time period, one of the guards came in and said, "Okay, you can go see your patients now." He wasn't allowed to dress, but he was seeing his patients while completely naked, and his patients are children. So this was a pediatrician who was instructed to round on his pediatric students, pediatric patients, while completely naked. It's absolutely disgusting. The only reason I saw this man is that he was eventually displaced south. On his journey south, he had no access to his medications, which included insulin. So he was very, very sick when he arrived in the south. He'd taken no insulin for 4 days. And he had a wound on his heel, which was so deep that he ultimately needed a skin graft, which is why he was at the hospital that I was serving at. You know, and this is a experience that I was able to actually corroborate because one of the other physicians who was held at gunpoint with him in the room was also in the same hospital that I served at. You know, it's absolutely disgusting that these things happen. And I wish I could say it's rare. I was there for only a few weeks and, you know, legitimately, I was horrified by hearing this. And yet the Palestinian doctors I was rounding with were not shocked at all. This was something that they witnessed every single day. Another gentleman I saw wasn't a healthcare professional, but he was actually a farmer from the central area of Gaza. And he had been abducted by Israel. His hands were tied very, very tight, and his ankles were also tied together very, very tight. He had deep wounds around his wrist that were so deep I could actually see his wrist bones. He had what's called osteomyelitis, which is an infection of the bone because they were tied so tight. He also had a very large wound on the back of his hand. It was probably, I would say, probably an inch and a half diameter hole in the back of his hand. And again, it was so deep, I could actually see the bones and ligaments in his hand. Now, my practice in Canada and even, you know, doing humanitarian work, my work is predominantly doing chronic diseases. I don't do a lot of surgery. Like, I'm not involved in surgical procedures. So that was a pattern of injury that I hadn't seen before. And I made the mistake of asking him how he got that wound. And I asked him that while there were Palestinian doctors around me, and I should have known not to ask it because it was traumatic what happened next. He had to describe to me what had happened, and what had happened is by his hands tied, they were never released. And every time he was moved from one location to the next, his feet were pulled up and he was dragged. And ultimately, when he tried to sleep, he would sleep like this. So again, putting pressure on the back. Or when he was pulled, he would drag, and the back of his hand, the skin would be pulled off as he was dragged from one place to the next. And ultimately, he had the skin, so much skin had been forced off the back of his hand that he actually needed a skin graft on the back of his hand. And I wish I could say this was rare. I wish I could say, oh yeah, this is something I saw once in Gaza. These types of injuries, everyone who was in custody that I spoke to, whether a physician or a non-physician civilian, every single one of them described some form of torture.
And, you know, me and Ben didn't talk about this before, and we went to Gaza at different times, and we were at different places in Gaza. And hearing him now, it's almost like he heard the doctors that I spoke to that had been assaulted and abducted. I mean, they're describing the same thing. And the last thing I'll mention, and, you know, you talk about what happened to Dr. Adnan, you know, that case, it wasn't covered in Western media, but everybody in Gaza knew about it. And that sort of reverberation of that sort of indignity that you're being treated with, that humiliation, even the idea of being stripped naked was something I heard the healthcare workers talk about who hadn't been abducted yet. And we're talking about, like, we don't want to go through that, like that humiliation part of it. Mm-hmm. So I think the downstream effect is really, really terrifying. And it, you know, it has, it's a very insidious thing, that pattern of behavior that Ben's talking about.
So you're saying that it's discouraging people from like sticking around or treating patients?
Well, I was at Al-Aqsa Hospital, and I remember one of the doctors who left when there was like some threat, and there was the hospital had been struck. And when he came back, some of the other doctors said, "How could you leave? Why did you leave?" He said, "Look at what they're doing to us."
Yeah.
This is what, and he would talk about these examples, and Adnan Bush had not been killed yet. So this was like, well, it's like a well-established fact. It's like there is no respect for healthcare workers or hospitals. There is no line that won't be crossed. And so that's something that sticks in the psyche of many people in Gaza. Everybody wants to live with dignity and respect. And in Gaza, in that society, with the values that Palestinians have that we care about, you know, the last thing you want is to be on your knees or to be asking for help or sticking your hand out. And for this to happen to a prominent orthopedic surgeon like Dr. Adnan Bush, somebody who everybody knows, to see that sort of violation take place, I mean, it's stuck in everybody's head.
Which yeah. makes the fact that people do stay all the more unbelievably courageous and kind of unthinkably brave. You know, when you guys were doing this press conference yesterday about the doctor, and you mentioned he was a dual citizen, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I hadn't heard that, and I couldn't believe it, because it just makes his bravery all the more kind of stunning, and his selflessness. You know, the fact that this guy could have gone to where is it?
Kazakhstan.
You know, after his son was killed. You know, I just want to, speaking of the Adnan al-Bursh, who again was the doctor who we knew was kidnapped. People didn't know where he was. And then he was in State Teman, by the way, which I didn't mention, is where the rape that was reported on occurred. And I think people think that this doctor is in State Teman as well, right? I don't know if that's, has it been confirmed, or is that just the...
I don't know if it's been confirmed. I think most likely that's where he is.
Yeah.
Hypothesized. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's also, you know, in addition to the rape cases there, that's one of the prisons that B'Tselem, the Israeli mm-hmm. human rights organization, they also called part of a network of torture sites.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
But I just want to show people how the New York Times reported. I mean, I guess it's in a way, wow, I can't believe they even reported on it at all. But here's how they reported on his death, which again, we know was basically following torture and sexual abuse. A Gaza doctor has died in Israeli custody, Palestinian groups say. Israel has not offered an explanation for the death of Dr. Adnan Ahmed al-Bursh, chief of orthopedics of Al-Shifa Hospital, 4 months after he was first detained. So honestly, I mean, the standards are so low that I was kind of shocked that they even reported on it. But of course, it's also disgusting that this is how they report on it. You know, typical like passive voice exonerating Israel.
He magically died with no Israeli input or yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to actually say that you know, we start the clock in the last 450 plus days on October 7th with regards to targeting of healthcare professionals and hospitals. And that's wrong. You know, I think it's really important to know this is not a new tactic. This strategy is longstanding. I mentioned Hamam Alo, who was killed, but a week after he was killed, Rafat Labad was killed. He was the head of internal medicine at Shifa Hospital. And he, in fact, replaced the person that he replaced had actually also been targeted and killed by the Israeli military in 2019. And the reason I bring up 2019 is that's when the March of Return protests were. We all remember, I attended the March of Return protests as a medic, and I was only there a couple times, you know, but realistically, when I was there, I saw snipers shoot children in the head, like 40 yards from me.
You witnessed it. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I knew it happened.
I testified to the ICC in 2019 about what I saw. And, you know, in addition to seeing children being shot in the head, I saw healthcare workers be shot in front of me. One of them, my team put a tourniquet on her leg while she herself was attending and caring for someone who had been shot by a sniper. And, you know, instructive to that is the United Nations actually had an independent report on the March of Return protests. And that independent report stated that Israel committed war crimes, but that they intentionally killed and aimed and used sniper fire against unarmed protesters, people who were handicapped, children, healthcare providers, reporters. This is not new, right? Like this is something that they have done before, targeting healthcare professionals. Independent observers have been saying this, and I saw it with my own eyes in 2019. So the fact they're doing it now, I think it's a reflection of the impunity with which Israel has been offered by protection from the United States and their other allies for years.
Yeah. One other thing I want to mention that I didn't share about this New York Times article is, in addition to its headline, is here's another gem from the article, which is that it says that it said he had been detained for national security reasons. So, mm-hmm. You know, as if that's a plausible reason. And I actually want to ask you about this. I mean, I feel conflicted about asking about it, but it's important because people are so propagandized about this. You know, people are just saying, well, he was part of Hamas, or he was this, that, the other. He was a terrorist. He had done this. What is your, I mean, first of all, that doesn't give you the right to torture and someone. But let's just, for argument's sake, let's say it did. Like, what is your response to that claim?
Katie, that's so garbage. I mean, it's such
absolute garbage. Yeah.
That they throw out there. For example, Dr. Hussam, again, they raided the hospital. They detained him. They questioned him and they let him go because he's just a pediatrician. So these excuses are so flimsy. Me and Ben have been to Gaza. We didn't see any sort of command centers. We didn't see any military operations taking place. And even, honestly, even if there was a command center below Shifa, does that matter if there's 40 babies in a NICU upstairs?
No. Yeah. Right.
And so like these are people who spend a lot of time. It's very hard to become a doctor out of Gaza. And me and Ben mm-hmm. can both attest to mm-hmm. that. It's really hard to become a doctor. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to specialize. And so they spend so much time doing that. And now all of the sudden, when you're killing a bunch of them and abducting a bunch of them, to just say national security, it's really garbage. And it's something that has been used. And I love that Ben brought up this point. It's like this pattern of attacking hospitals, healthcare workers, it's not new. The Israeli military has normalized this and they've been doing it for a long time. And even, you know, with my own family members, just going back to the first Intifada, you just say national security and you can easily lock somebody away for 6 months and keep renewing that detention every six months. Yeah. And suddenly people are losing 5-10 years of their lives under these national security sort of, the label. And they get out and it's like, oh, you're just releasing these terrorists just back, you know, you're just letting them go.
Yeah.
So it's just, it just doesn't hold any water.
You know, these claims about healthcare providers being Hamas, or hospitals being used by terrorists, they've been around for more than a decade. You know, since at least 2008, Israel has argued that armed groups are using hospitals. And yet, healthcare providers who've been there have never seen it, right? There's been probably a dozen independent investigations looking into this, starting probably with the 2009 Goldstone report. And subsequently, you know, there's reports after 2012, after 2014, after 2019, after 2021, after 2022. There's one even in 2024, more recently, after the genocide started. All of them have found exactly the same thing, that there's no evidence that hospitals are being used for terrorist activities. Yeah. So, I mean, the problem is, it's, you know, Israel has so effectively controlled the narrative that it's essentially feeding into anti-Palestinian racism, claiming that, well, Palestinians are terrorists. And it's so effectively created that narrative that saying that a hospital is a hotbed of terrorism is actually believable with absolutely no evidence. And in fact, not only no evidence, but evidence to the contrary. What Right. we've seen is that, as an example, the Turkish Friendship Hospital in Gaza, this was the only hospital that was being used for chemotherapy and radiation treatments for adults with cancer in Gaza. That hospital was taken over, bombarded, and then used as a military site by Israel. That is against international humanitarian law. They are not allowed to do that. And yet that was not reported, that they are literally using a hospital for a military site. Israel is. They did the exact same thing at the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza. So, you know, it's really hard when you're thinking about the fact they're coming forward with these arguments and yet they themselves are doing it. And we know that they're doing it. And it's report the exact opposite is being reported.
And often they'll say a claim, it's believed, and then maybe they'll acknowledge, they're forced to acknowledge it's not true. And by then it's out of the headlines and everyone's already absorbed it.
That's right.
That's a good point. You know, I was at Nasser Hospital and the Israeli military put a tweet that a rocket was fired from the compound while I was there 24/7. And there was never any rocket. And I actually recently went back and found that they deleted that tweet. So there's never any explanation. They raided the hospital. They abducted a bunch of people. Never any explanation for it. It's just kind of the, you know, business as usual.
Right. That's what, I mean, they, just one example is that they did that with Shireen Abu Akleh, right? They said that she had been killed by a Palestinian. They released video and of course it wasn't true. And then the US was like, oh yeah, it may have been done by Israel, but by then it was out of the news. And speaking of how the US enables Israel, let's take a look at this clip of Karine Jean-Pierre being asked by a journalist about this kidnapping.
The administration.
Say that one more time.
Human rights and upholding international law has been a priority for this administration. But we're not disputing that, right?
No, I'm not disputing that. You're correct. That is something that when I'm asked about it, we say that the president brings that up when he has meetings or bilateral meetings with world leaders. He brings that up and it's always something that...
Oops.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, while we do that, it's also worth, I think, reminding people that they never wind up providing evidence of these being terrorist hotbeds. But even so, that doesn't actually let people, like under international law, you can't just bomb a hospital, even that were the case. And it's not the case, but even if it were. But I think it's Francesca Albanese calls it like humanitarian camouflage when they try to use the language of international law and humanitarian law to justify things that actually violate those.
And you know, you play this clip, and this is what's frustrating about this administration that's leaving office pretty soon, is they provide so much cover for these horrific things that are taking place. And I, you know, I would just also mention the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Jack Luz, recently, when a report came out about famine in the north from the Famine Early Warning System. This is a USAID-funded organization that monitors famine. This guy came out very impassioned speech about how it's inaccurate and dangerous and there is no famine in North Gaza. You're like, wait, are you a U.S. ambassador to Israel? Are you an Israeli ambassador to the U.S.?
Right.
Like, what is going on here? That's not how you respond to a report saying there might be famine. You should be flooding the north of Gaza with food and vitamins and water. Instead, you have this guy saying, no, there's not that many people there. It's a dangerous report. And actually, they had to pull the report. USAID got so much pressure from the State Department, they pulled that report.
Blinken also covered that up. He covered up the blocking of humanitarian aid.
From two different organizations, and like two different U.S. organizations came to the same conclusion. And Secretary Blinken knew about both of those and then subsequently lied.
Yeah.
You know.
You can see also how he's trying... sorry to bring this up, but he just did that sit down with the New York Times.
Yeah.
He's clearly already trying to dictate what his legacy is going to be and trying to separate from what's going on in Gaza. To me, that indicates he knows it's bad, the policies that took place in Gaza, and is trying to say, well, no, it's not actually like this. And we tried to do a lot. And a lot of the, if there is a ceasefire, it's going to be all of the things that we wanted. You're like, there's, you know, so tens of thousands of people that are now dead because we didn't rise up to the occasion. Do what we were supposed to do.
It's so awful. Brad, is that clip ready? Okay.
Disputing that, right? No, not disputing that. You're correct. That is something that when I'm asked about it, we say that the president brings that up when he has meetings or bilateral meetings with world leaders. He brings that up, and it's always something that we certainly focus on, for sure.
So I don't know if you've seen Amnesty International report, but basically the detailing the arrest of doctors, health workers in Gaza, and some of them has endured torture. On December 27th, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, he's the doctor for Kemal Adwan Hospital, was arrested. And till now, we don't know what he's aware of that. And there is fear from Amnesty International for his life. What is the White House doing to talk with a close ally like yours, which is Israel, to make sure that his life is spared and he's safe?
So on that particular matter, I would I don't have anything to share on any conversation on that specific amnesty situation. Obviously, when it comes to humanitarian assistance, we continue certainly to be concerned of the lack of humanitarian assistance. This is something that we talk directly with our Israeli counterparts in the government. And so we will continue to do that. You've seen Secretary Blinken and others who have gone into the region and have those conversations with Israel about that. I don't have anything to share about that particular instance. I would have to talk to the team. But that is something that we certainly take very seriously when it comes to humanitarian aid and humanitarian workers being able to be allowed to the job. But I can't speak to that particular report. I have to talk to our team. I want to be really, really mindful on that.
But would you agree that arresting doctors in hospitals is a violation of human rights?
I want to be super mindful because you're asking me about a particular incident that has occurred, and I just want to make sure I have all of the information. I don't want to give you an answer without having all the information. And so I'm just going to be super mindful and leave it there.
I mean, using the word like this is a mindfulness practice or something.
We're living in a different world.
I mean, they're just tiptoeing around any sort of, you know, like, oh, this could be something wrong. They don't even want us to use any sort of negative connotation to any word.
Right.
Yeah. And that's really that. Right. It's just so disappointing because this is the real deal. And instead, you know, we have to play this sort of these games around, okay, how can we best provide diplomatic cover, political cover? How can we best play the PR game for Israel as opposed to maybe we should look into this?
And we sneer at it, but realistically, like, we should be disgusted. We should be disgusted watching that, knowing that even while Gaza is experiencing a genocide, millions and millions of dollars are being spent by American taxpayers to continue to fund weapons to support this genocide and to provide diplomatic cover.
And Biden just approved another $8 billion arms sale to Israel, by the way.
Yeah, to kill children who are living in tents. You know, it's an exercise in how do we get away with saying nothing so that we don't look guilty for supporting a genocide. That's what we're watching. It's really quite disgusting.
It's incredible because she can't even condemn it. And like, she wouldn't even say to that journalist, Nadia, I'm sorry, I forget her name, but she does great stuff. Yeah. Couldn't even say to her that, yeah, of course, in principle, like kidnapping doctors is wrong. She couldn't even say that because that would come off as condemning Israel. Right. And because everyone knows that they really did that. Or if when it comes out that they did that, then she'll have been seen as condemning them. And they're our special friend. I just want to ask you, both of you, actually. So Thayer, you were given the chance to speak to Biden. Can you talk about what happened there? And then I'll ask you, Ben, about your experience talking to the Justin Trudeau team.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you saw just in that recent clip. there was no seriousness about figuring out what is going on the ground in Gaza. I was told I was the first person who had been on the ground to brief the president. And this was back in April. It was after the World Central Kitchen attack happened, where they were targeted with three separate missiles in their convoy after clearing all coordinates with the Israelis. It was after another arms sale had been approved and a fighter jet sale had been approved. And so there was this constant sort of attitude when it came to the Biden administration about making sure that they were supporting the Israelis in any fashion and not having what they called daylight between them and the Israelis. Right. And they even used that term recently, and they used it with me, where they don't want to show any daylight between them and the Israelis because they felt like Palestinian groups would take advantage of that, all while there was this massacre taking place and there was this fear that Rafah was going to be invaded. We appealed to them, just say, please, you know, as I was getting up to walk away from him, I said, just don't let them invade Rafah. There's an orphan in a tent. Here's a letter from her begging you, don't let them invade Rafah. It will be a bloodbath. And Rafah was invaded, and indeed it was a bloodbath, and we saw sort of what took place. I mean, that's sort of been the consistent messaging from the Biden administration, as well as their policies. It's like, let's do whatever we can to continue to support. Let's veto at the UN Security Council any resolutions that bring about accountability. Let's make sure that all of the guns and the bullets are needed. Let's make sure that anytime something tries to come up with respect to, hey, there was a poor incident, let's be very vague about, oh, we don't know the details yet. Let's wait till we hear more information. So it was, to me, you know, it was a moment where they demonstrated their true character to me in person, and they've continued to do that even until these last few days. Like, we are talking about them leaving office in 10 days. There are no more political considerations they have to
exactly
about, right. Like, mm-hmm. He's not running for re-election. There's somebody else coming in. Just try to do the right thing. And instead, you're getting answers like the ones that we just heard. It was, you know, a really miserable conversation. I'm glad I walked away from him when I did.
And what did he say?
He said he understood. I mean, he first condescendingly was like, you guys, because there was a group of us, he's like, you guys are going to say stuff. I hope you know we know a lot about the situation, that we're working really hard. And in my head, I'm like, you guys just approved more fighter jets, more two-ton bombs. Mm-hmm. You just allowed this World Central Kitchen attack to take place. And by the way, the World Food Program just had a car that was under attack. And, you know, nobody can accuse Cindy McCain of being, you know, a Palestinian right. terrorist or pro-Palestinian bias, right? So, you know, this is just a pattern of behavior that they allowed and they condoned and they have continued to support and provide a lot of cover for. And so he said, as I got up to walk away, I said, I'm going to walk away from you like you walked away from us, like you walked away from the Palestinian people. And he said, I understand. You do what you got to do. And, you know, I just went on out. And of course, over the next weeks, we saw the military level Rafah. And, you know, we're still dealing with this now, several months later, with where they're going back to places that they have already destroyed. And so, yeah, it's really been a total disaster and failure. And I don't care what they try to do to change the narrative about this. This is something that will forever be attached to them for all of history. You know, this is what their legacy will be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the fact that they're doing it without any political justification now, it's just, I mean, not that it would have been okay, but not that it was okay before, but it's even it's like, you're that committed. Like, he really is a true believer. It's insane. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what about your experience? I know you spoke to people in the Trudeau administration. And then, of course, tell us about Trudeau, the news about Trudeau.
Yeah. I mean, in November of 2023, I met with the Prime Minister's office in Canada. This was Prime Minister Trudeau's office. And it was, in fact, myself with the heads of three major charities, including Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders in Canada. We all met. And to say the response was disappointing would be an understatement. You know, we prepared lots of educational material in advance that we communicated about the fact that there were already thousands of orphans. We provided them evidence of targeting of the healthcare system, targeting of water, targeting of electricity, intentional destruction of water systems, sewage systems, already multiple reports of spreading infectious diseases, which ultimately culminated into polio later on. We provided them evidence of all of this. And also reflected on the decisions that Canada had made internationally at the United Nations, even with regards to Palestinian right for self-determination, to have a state, that Canada has historically voted with Israel on, which is shameful. we reflected on all this. And of course, the response we got was, well, you know, Canada is in a position to really influence our ally Israel, but we're going to do it behind closed doors. That's what we were told. And there's been absolutely no evidence that that's actually ever taken place. In fact, quite a lot of evidence to the contrary. Prime Minister Trudeau has repeatedly met with and repeated speaking points from the Israel lobby groups in Canada, including CIJA, CIJA, and B'nai B'rith. Repeatedly, essentially just, you might as well copy and paste his words with what he's been handed from the Israel lobby. I'm thankful that he resigned this week. But on the other hand, I'm also cognizant of the fact that right now leading in the polls in Canada is the Progressive Conservative Party, the leader of whom, the right-hand person, is Melissa Lantzman, who is essentially, she might as well work for Israel. She might as well. You know, her everything she has repeatedly, repeated things that have already been debunked. Like she's still a month ago talking about beheaded babies from October 7th. It's like, come on. Like, it's the dehumanizing rhetoric that has come from the Progressive Conservative Party is equally concerning. We don't have really a party that can win in Canada right now that is willing to confront Israel on their war crimes. We don't have one.
Yeah, it's awful. Something we share with you here in the United States. Wanted to ask each of you, and you've been so generous with your time, just a couple more questions. Ben, can you tell us about your suspension? And then Thayer, I want to ask you about your uncle and also about yet another doctor who was just murdered.
Yeah.
And we have her photo to show. But yeah.
Yeah, so I was suspended by my hospital in October of 2023. I'd actually just come back from Gaza in September 2023. And I was in regular contact with physicians on the ground pretty much every single day, multiple physicians, other healthcare providers. And on October 8th, many of them were worried about what would happen next. And by October 9th, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, came out with a statement where he referred to Palestinians as human animals and talked about how Israel would be cutting off water, cutting off electricity. And they did. That's exactly what they did. And people in people in Gaza knew that a genocide was coming, and some of them argued that it was already taking place. It just so happened at about that time, there was a horrendous amount of dehumanizing rhetoric and lies spread about Palestinians in Gaza. There were, some of them are well established and now debunked, such as mass rape, 40 beheaded babies, babies put in ovens, all this nonsense. And it was pretty obvious to many of us that it was nonsense, that it was propaganda and garbage. One of Canada's members of parliament, Sarah Jama, had posted after October 7th a message, public message, trying to put October 7th into the context of a decades-long illegal occupation and a system of apartheid. And using those words, she immediately became a target of the Israel lobby in Canada, who attacked her. I attempted to defend her. I attempted to say, you know, Israel is already committing war crimes and is probably already committing genocide. What the Israel lobby groups in Canada have communicated has already been debunked. It's false. There were no beheaded babies. And at that point, the investigations about sexual violence hadn't been completed. And so I said, there isn't any evidence yet of sexual violence. There hasn't been any beheaded babies. Israel is already committing war crimes and genocide. And so within 24 hours, there was a very organized campaign in which two Israel lobby groups directly communicated with my hospital CEO and demanded that I be fired. There was a letter writing campaign facilitated mostly through private Facebook groups, Twitter, Instagram, in which people were encouraged to write letters to complain about me to get me fired. The hospital received a couple hundred letters within 24 hours. And they have ultimately capitulated and suspended me. Now, they suspended me, and later realizing that I was going to fight back, suggested that they did not actually suspend me for my views on Israel, that they suspended me for my own safety, which, you know, I find hilarious. But, you know, needless to say, I'm in litigation against the hospital. And, you know, it was unfortunate that I was one of the first in Canada to be suspended. But what we've seen subsequent to that is literally dozens and dozens of people have been suspended. Many of them have not been heard about because they're learners, they're residents, they're medical students, and they've chosen to, you know, either accept to be suspended and be out of school for a year, or to apologize and go back to school when they don't want to apologize, but they're worried about their future, right? And so sadly, these techniques of bullying, they've been effective. And I'm lucky to be in a position where I can sue and see it through, and quite happy that it's going to be expensive. It's going to be intermittently demoralizing, but I don't care. What they did is wrong, and they have to be held accountable for it. I think it's something that we've seen in Canada, in US. We've seen it not just amongst health providers, we've seen it amongst other people in civil society, whether lawyers, other people from all aspects of society who are speaking out are being targeted. And the conflation of anti-Israel statements with anti-Semitism, we're all very familiar with that. In addition to being suspended from the hospital, my name now appears on Canary Mission and a couple other similar sites that attempt to punish people who speak out against Israel. I'm not intimidated by that. I know that at the end of the day, there'll be a moment of reckoning where we look back at this time and what we do actually matters right now. What we do, like being silent in the face of a genocide, is not something that I, as a conscientious human being and physician, can ever do. I can't do it. You know, I have to look at my 3-year-old daughter and be able to look at the person in the mirror and accept who it is. I can't do that now if I'm not speaking out. I can't. So if they fire me, that's fine. It'll just be more expensive for them.
Well, I'm sorry that that happened, but it's inspiring that you're so resilient in the face of that. I'm sure it's also, you know, having seen the resilience of the people of Gaza, it probably seems like a very small price to pay. Not to downplay.
Yeah, no, it, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Many of us have had friends killed in the last year. Many of us who've worked in Gaza have had friends killed, have been suspended, have been targeted, have been smeared. But I mean, my worst day in the last year is still better than anyone's day in Gaza over that same time period. There's no doubt about that.
Right. And Thayer, tell us about the latest doctor who was just killed that we know of, at least. And we have her photo. And also tell us about the status of your uncle.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the photo you're about to see is of a young doctor. Her name is Thabet Salim. She was working at Al-Aqsa Hospital and Al-Awda Hospital, was hoping that she could specialize and become a neonatologist. Here she can see her treating a baby in the NICU at Al-Aqsa. And she was somebody who finished her shift, went back home to Nusayrat camp in central Gaza, and a missile struck the area that she was in, and she lost her life. And so she's among the more than, 1,000 healthcare workers now that have been killed in this conflict. And, you know, it's really just horrifying to think that somebody like this, again, who, you know, is so bright and has struggled so much to get to where she's at, and to see her lose her life like this, to be killed so mercilessly, and it's not even going to make any headline in the Western world whatsoever. Nobody's going to try to remember her name. I'm glad that we're putting her picture up, because, you know, she's one of the heroes that, you know, that has fallen now. This is kind of, these are the people who we're losing in Gaza on a daily basis, in the tens, in the 20s, in the dozens. We're at a point where I think people are fatigued, but it's like, when you just think about who they were and what they meant for their communities that they served, I mean, we should remember who they are. We should remember their names. We should remember what their goals were. And so she's just, you know, another number right now. And I hope, though, that as we get what I hope is, as we get closer to the end of this, that we actually take a second to look back at everybody that we've lost and try to honor them in whatever way that we can and remember who they were, their names and their families. And, you know, I mean, Ben, kind of you guys both mentioned it. It's like my uncle was picked up in September by the Israeli military in the West Bank. The home was raided. They live in a small apartment in an apartment building, and they raided the home. And he has four kids. The oldest is 15 years old. And they just stormed in the middle of the night. He's still wearing sort of his undershirt, and he was wearing his flip-flops. And they pick him up and they abduct him, and they destroy the house. And I have an aunt who lives with him, who she's disabled. And they're all sort of traumatized from this. And from that moment, they've not been able to speak to him. Not his kids, his wife, nobody has been able to speak to him. They've had to get these little messages that he can give to a lawyer that tells, and he's constantly saying, "I'm all right. It's okay." And again, the whole mentality is like this, you know, in the grand scheme of things, in comparison to what's happening in Gaza, this is the least that we can do. This is the least that we can sort of try to be resilient, you know, try to sit here and not, you know, want to be down on ourselves. And he's somebody who's no stranger to the Israeli military prison system. He's been multiple times while he used to work for UNRWA. He's a sociologist. He's somebody who multiple times has had his career interrupted, his education interrupted, just for being a Palestinian in the West Bank, just getting picked up. He is, of course, I hate to even justify saying this. I honestly hate it, but I want people to know what kind of person he is. But he's like this very eloquent speaker. You know, he's somebody who loves Arabic poetry, loves history. He's not that dehumanization sort of like caricature of Palestinians that is always constantly put out there. He's one of the many Palestinians that are just like him, that love going to cafes and talking about politics and sports. And so he's been in there. They constantly postpone the date of his trial every single time, postponing it because he has no charge against him. And he's really, of course, he's done nothing wrong. And I want to say one last thing about something that they did that actually infuriates me. And they thought that the Israeli military thought that this would be a way to sort of embarrass my family. But after they raided the house and destroyed kind of the apartment, they put this large sticker on the front of it. And they said, one of the kids of your neighborhood, talking about my 55-year-old uncle, engaged in terrorist activities. So take caution for yourselves and your family and avoid him and do not be like him, so that you don't suffer a similar fate. And, you know, what they're trying to embarrass, they're trying to humiliate. But one of my uncles told me, he goes, "This is actually a badge of honor." Like, what they're saying is that they, you know, they had to come and get this guy because he probably stood up against what they were doing in Gaza. And he's obviously always been on the right side of history. So, you know, kind of Ben talking about like looking at his kids and being able to speak up during this moment. I mean, I know that that's what my uncle is, how my uncles feel and how my family feels. But, you know, the truth is his kids are young and they are affected by their father being missing, you know, and I see it on them when I talk to them. So it's going to have a profound effect on them for the rest of their lives. This very traumatic incident that took place, just like every kid in Gaza is traumatized by what's taken place over the last 16 months. And anybody who's been alive long enough remembers the incidents that Ben's was talking about with the March of Return. Or even, you know, if they were alive for any of the other subsequent aggressions on Gaza. So, you know, and it's become it's a reality. Like the way we talk about it, it's sort of like if you talk to any Palestinian circle, it's like, yeah, this is life. You know, this is what we do. We go through checkpoints. We get humiliated. We get administrative detention in Israeli prisons. We have a tough time leaving any area. You're not going to be able to pursue your dreams. Like that's just become like, this is who we are. This is, you know, and that's what kills me. That's what really, really bothers me the most.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so sorry to hear that. And it's sadly, as we've been discussing, not surprising. But you know, that is why we have to do everything we can to make sure that this is not something people can ignore.
Yeah.
Words kind of fail, but
you remind me that when I was in September, when he got caught up, my youngest brother was going to get married and we already were not going to do like a celebratory wedding. We were just going to kind of have a dinner because of what's happening in Gaza. And we were like, we should cancel it because, you know, he's arrested and stuff. And my entire family back home was like, don't even think about it. Like, don't give the satisfaction of us altering and not getting married and like starting our families and, you know, having that traditional Palestinian, like, don't even think about it. Like, that's the thing you have to do right now. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what, you know, that's kind of the mentality that a lot of us have.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much to both of you, and keep up the great work, and would love to have you back on. And there is so much more we could talk about, but so we'll have to do this again.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me and for the great work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Have a great night. Well, don't go anywhere, guys. That was a really moving segment, and I'm just always amazed by people who risk their lives to save the lives of others. If you haven't given this a like, give it a like, again, just because it'll help get more people to see the stream and the really important interviews that we're doing. And now we're shifting gears a little bit, and we're going to bring on two other excellent guests. And this time we're going to be talking about a civil war. An alleged civil war. I don't know. Is it real? Is it fake? Is it a distraction? But definitely a controversy that's happening among MAGA, within MAGA, I should say. And to help us understand this and make sense of this, we're joined by two guests. We're joined by Ron Hira, an Economic Policy Institute research associate, an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Howard University. His book, Outsourcing America, was one of the first to examine the economic and policy implications of the offshoring of high-skilled jobs. It was a finalist for the Benjamin Franklin Awards in the Best Business Book category. Hira has testified before Congress on offshoring and high-skilled immigration. He's frequently interviewed by the media about his work, which intersects STEM, labor markets, immigration, globalization, and competitiveness policy. He is a licensed professional engineer. And Quinn Slobodian is a professor of international history at the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. His books, which have been translated into 10 languages, include, most recently, Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy. Forthcoming is Hayek's Bastards, Race, Gold, IQ, and the Capitalism of the Far Right. He has been an associate fellow at Chatham House and held residential fellowships at Harvard and FU Berlin. He co-directs the History and Political Economy Project and is on the board of editors of the American Historical Review. In 2024, Prospect UK named him one of the world's 25 top thinkers. So, Ron and Quinn, welcome to the show. Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having us on.
Of course. So, I wanted to ask you guys, We're going to talk about, you know, this divide within the MAGA camp that was in some ways sparked by a Vivek Krishnaswamy tweet. And we're going to show that. But obviously, as people may know, this was about H-1B visas. And Ron, as someone who's written a lot about this issue, could you just walk us through what these things are and why they matter?
Yeah, sure. So the H-1B visa is one of what we call a guest worker visa. It's called a temporary non-immigrant work visa. And by guest worker, I mean that people are invited in as workers, as guests, and they're welcome to stay as guests as long as they're working and working for an employer. So it's a work permit. It is not permanent residence. And it's an important visa because it's a skilled work permit, so you need to have at least a bachelor's degree. So it's one of the key ways that people who have skills do come in and work in the U.S. And it's a very large program. So there's about 600,000 H-1B guest workers here in the U.S., which is a lot. I mean, it has a real impact, particularly in the tech sector. But what's interesting about it was created in a classic sort of Washington bait and switch way. It was created to fill labor market shortages. So when there's non-American workers who are able to do it, you're going to bring in some super specialized foreign worker to fill this gap. But in reality, when they wrote the law and then they've written the rules afterwards, they made it so wishy-washy, so easy that virtually anybody can qualify for an H-1B. And the way they put the wage protections and everything in, there's a big incentive for employers to bring in foreign workers below market wages. And then there's also an indenturing component to the visa itself. So it's a kind of a classic bait and switch where the presentation is, this is a great visa for the geniuses and everything else. But in reality, the typical H-1B worker has ordinary skills, is being brought in into occupations and jobs where there's lots of Americans who are willing and able to do the job. And then the employer has actually captured that worker and is able to control that worker in ways that they would not be able to control you or I, because we would just quit.
As someone who was on an H-1B in the past, I can testify that it definitely is an ordinary person thing to have.
Right.
And it also brings in very highly skilled people. I'm sure Quinn is one. So, and that's one of the challenges in talking about this, because you can pick and choose different people and you'll say, well, you know, if Elon Musk came in on it, or if Quinn came on it, it must be everybody who comes in on it is of that caliber. But in fact, they're in the minority. They don't have to be, but they are.
Don't insult them by comparing them to Elon Musk. That's terrible. Yeah. What's your H-1B story?
Well, I'm Canadian, and it's a pretty standard way for people to get their early access to visas as junior professors out of graduate school, as you apply for an H-1B, actually a specialized version of that called an O-1. Which maybe Ron knows more details on, which is described as being an extraordinary alien. But certainly the mass of these workers are coming in working for tech firms in ways that clearly depress wages in sectors that do have Americans who are qualified.
Right. And we're going to talk about this and how this kind of intersects with this MAGA divide. Quinn, how would you kind of frame this divide between these two polls, if you will, of Trump supporters?
Well, it's interesting because it's actually something I write about in the book that you mentioned that's coming out in April, Hayek's Bastards. There was a kind of a similar debate in the 1990s that pitted, on the one hand, kind of nativist ethno-nationalists like Peter Brimelow, who wanted to sort of preserve the whiteness and the European-derived qualities of America, and thus basically exclude non-white immigrants, pitted that sort of ethnically defined idea of immigration and control and reform against what was called designer immigration. So Ben Wattenberg was someone who pushed that, and that was considered the liberal version, but it itself was also set up to kind of revise birthright citizenship. So the idea there was, you know, rather than quote unquote chain migration and the expansion of the American population through relationships, families, children, and so on, that you would be able to select, also sometimes described as the Canadian system, along a kind of a points model in which you could select for skills and exclude based on people who you perceive to be sort of welfare dependent. So this is tapping into a pretty long-standing debate within the GOP especially, and it's a way that sort of what can appear like a cosmopolitan or liberal position is actually itself an attempt to reform into a more restrictive form what already exists currently as the American citizenship model. But I think that, I mean, the fascinating thing is that the sort of figurehead of this, Elon Musk, is sort of trying to do both strategies right now, right? I mean, it's like, depends if you ask if we're talking about December Elon or January Elon. December Elon was saying, it's a meritocracy. We select people based on skill and look at me and look at other people of foreign origin and so on, seeming to be edging towards the sort of designer immigration points model. But January Elon is scaremongering about what he calls genocidal rape in the UK, is posting statistical table after statistical table showing that rates of crime in European countries are higher in foreign-born groups than in native-born groups. So he's trying to effectively do both, have both a meritocratic point system and an ethnically defined kind of pro-European reframing of who citizens and potential immigrants should be.
Right. Yeah, I thought, Ron, do you have a response to that? If not,
I'd make a little bit of a distinction here, and I think there's some important ones. I agree with what Quinn's talking about when you're talking about permanent immigration. So let's distinguish and separate permanent immigration, what we call colloquially green cards, which allows someone to stay permanently in the U.S. and then apply for citizenship after, I believe it's 5 years. And they don't have, they're not tied to employment. They don't have to work in order to stay permanently. They're just like you and me. They can stay, they can leave and come back and so on and so forth. They're not tied to employment. Whereas a guest worker really is a guest. It's a temporary visa non-immigrant. And It's important because a couple of things. I'll get back to the permanent immigration in a second, which I think is what Quinn is really kind of focused on. They're tied together, but they're a little bit different. There's more than 1 million skilled guest workers on various different visas, 600,000 on H-1Bs, another 300,000 on OPT, and it's a whole alphabet soup. There's TN visas, E-3, L-1, and so on and so forth. So there's over 1 million guest workers, you know, who have largely a bachelor's degree or higher. And we only grant 60,000 green cards to workers each year. So compare that, 1 million guest workers, 60,000 permanent residents for those skilled workers. And that's a huge imbalance. And that's a problem in and of itself, because guest workers, by definition, have far fewer employment rights than what permanent residents have. So our skilled immigration system really isn't, if you look under the hood, there's really not any immigration going on, very little, 60,000 versus over 1 million guest workers. It's mostly a guest worker, set of guest worker programs that are complicated, really confusing to explain and understand. Certainly policymakers, and I talk to a lot of people up on Capitol Hill and whatnot, they have really no idea how any of this works. The people who know how it works are the people who are exploiting it, the employers, the immigration attorneys, and the like. So we have a huge imbalance, and the way we select for guest workers is not very good, and we can get into those details. Now, if we take a step back and say, well, what do we have in terms of permanent immigration? We have about 1.1 million green cards that are granted. And as Quinn said, most of that is family-based. So about two-thirds, about 65%, is family unification. So this is, you know, parents or children and siblings, spouses. So if you marry somebody who's not, they can get permanent immigration and it's tiered. But most of our system is geared towards family. About 15% or so is humanitarian. So these are refugees and asylees who will get permanent residence. And then 15% is this employment base. But in reality, because they're counting the dependents, it's really more like 6 or 7%. And then another 6% is what's called the diversity lottery. So part of the problem with the conversation is we're not really talking about immigration when we're talking about H-1B. That's really a guest worker program. And all of this complexity does nobody any good in terms of thinking about the policy. But guest workers have a lot fewer rights. Employers love this because they can control them. You know, permanent residents will have a very different impact on the labor market, whether they came in as family members through family unification or through an employment-based green card, which is a very small share of the permanent residents.
I think that's very helpful, I think, to have that clarification. But I think it's also important to note that, you know, the politics of this comes out of the collapsing of the distinctions that you're making, right? I mean, how this becomes a topic of debate is that the distinction between, I think, you know, undocumented immigrants, people who entered the country in an unauthorized way, temporary immigrants, and then people who are on green cards on a path to citizenship, that those three categories are not separated out in the MAGA mind whatsoever, and I would say are blurred tactically in the sort of Elon and Vivek mind as well. So I think, you know, whilst keeping in mind the sort of technical distinction, I think that to understand the rhetoric of this and how this is turning into something that's producing schisms, I mean, it's because of the kind of flipping between those categories and the way that they're not at all being treated carefully or with distinction. I mean, even Musk's own language of H-1B and his own story implies a kind of pathway to permanent residency, right? I mean, the story is not, I came, I got some skills and went home. The path is, I came, got some skills, and then they recognized my genius and I made money and I stayed and so on. So, right? So this, it's about, I think, trying to produce a starker than an actual distinction between insiders who deserve to be here and then foreigners who don't. And all of the gray area that, of course, exists is being, you know, tactically played with by all sides.
Right. And so I agree with that. I mean, there's this sort of good versus bad. But I think it's also reasonable to have a conversation of do we change the permanent immigration system in terms of moving away from family or maybe moving away from the, I'm not advocating these. I think there's good arguments to keep it the way it is. But other countries, like you mentioned, Canada has a merit point system, Australia, the UK, where you have some kind of hybrid model. I was just giving that background. But I agree that a lot of the rhetoric is around these are good, these are bad, and that's legal versus illegal, or, you know, legal versus undocumented. And then, of course, the whole guest worker program. But when they are talking about guest workers, they're melding that together. These are all good, right? All the guest workers are good.
Right. So I want to get into what should be done and the solutions to this, especially given that, you know, obviously guest workers are different from the border crisis, but it is part of the same kind of theme of immigration. And there's so much fear mongering about immigration. And I find it actually hard to talk about this in a way, even like for leftists to talk about this sometimes in a way that doesn't lean into xenophobia. And I think that's something that can hamstring the conversation. But before we get into that, I just want to take a look at this kind of sensationalist war that was provoked, I think in part by, I mean, obviously these are larger issues about the right. But let's take a look at this tweet from Elon Musk that I think was on December 25th.
Lovely day to be posting.
I know, yeah. There's a permanent shortage of excellent engineering talent. It is the fundamental limiting factor in Silicon Valley. Okay, so that's a tweet. Then let's take a look at this Vivek tweet that also contributed to this kind of firestorm. It's a long one. It's a doozy.
It's a blue check tweet.
Yeah, right. It's a blue check tweet. Yeah. So we'll just read some of it. The reason top tech companies often hire foreign-born and first-generation engineers over Native Americans isn't because of an innate American IQ deficit, a lazy and wrong explanation. A key part of it comes down to the C word, culture. Tough questions demand tough answers, and if we're really serious about fixing the problem, we have to confront the truth. Our American culture has venerated mediocrity over excellence for way too long, at least since the 90s and likely longer. That doesn't start in college, it starts young. A culture that celebrates the prom queen over the math Olympiad champ or the jock over the valedictorian will not produce the best engineers. A culture that venerates Corey from Boy Meets World or Zach and Slater over Screech and Saved by the Bell or Stefan over Steve Urkel in Family Matters will not produce the best engineers. Fact, I know multiple sets of immigrant parents in the 90s who actively limited how much their kids could watch those TV shows precisely because they promoted mediocrity, and their kids went on to become widely successful STEM graduates. More movies like Whiplash, fewer reruns of Friends, more math tutoring, fewer sleepovers, more weekend science competitions, fewer Saturday morning cartoons, more books, less TV, more creating, less chilling, more extracurriculars, less hanging out at the mall. I think, all right, I'll read a little bit more. Most normal American parents look skeptically at those kinds of parents, in quotes. More normal American kids view such those kinds of kids with scorn. If you grow up aspiring to normalcy, normalcy is what you will achieve. Now close your eyes and visualize which families you know in the 90s or even now who raised their kids according to one model versus the other. Be brutally honest. Normalcy doesn't cut it in a hyper-competitive global market for technical talent. And if we pretend like it does, we'll have our asses handed to us by China. This can be our Sputnik moment. We've awakened from slumber before and we can do it again. Trump's election hopefully marks the beginning of a new golden era in America, but only if our culture fully wakes up. A culture that once again prioritizes achievement over normalcy, excellence over mediocrity, nerdiness over conformity, hard work over laziness. That's the work we have to cut out for us rather than wallowing in victimhood and just wishing or legislating alternative hiring practices into existence. I'm confident we can do it. All right. So what say ye to this especially, but to both of them?
I mean, it's really not for nothing that he mentions the 90s so much, right? Because this really is just back to the 90s. I mean, this is Asian values talk. This was in the 90s, there's a lot of talk about what's happening in Singapore that's making things so much better. Why are IQ rates actually higher amongst Asian, especially East Asian immigrant children, and testing in places like Taiwan and Japan? Is it genetic? Is it racial? Is it a question of values and upbringing? I mean, these are decades old questions. They were actually reverberating in the UK conservative debate a couple of years ago with the so-called Britannia Unchained document put together by people who a few years later were running the government, Kwasi Kwarteng, and Dominic Raab and Elizabeth Truss. exactly the same, saying, why is it that kids from Indian families do so much better? And in the background is always, and Black kids don't do well. I mean, he's not saying it out loud, but he effectively is saying chillin and mentioning Urkel as the kind of, you know, the wrong model of Black masculinity, I suppose. I mean, the idea here is that there is a kind of a bad model of child rearing and education, and it's just barely subtextual or sotto voce what that is. So it's still, we're still like doing Moynihan Report. It's not even 90s, it's like 60s.
Right.
So I would just say this is an old tune. It's just, it's been happening in the Republican Party. One of the many ways Vivek is playing also like a Dinesh D'Souza playbook. I mean, he was saying the same stuff in the 90s as well.
Yeah. And what about you, Ron? Because I know that you actually responded to this tweet yourself, but we could read your tweet, but I thought it'd be a little more exciting for you to actually just say it.
I don't know how exciting it'll be because it's data, right? Which, unlike these sort of...
Oh, no, you're right. Let's show this tweet. You're right. It is data.
It's sort of half-cocked.
Can we show that tweet?
Cultural tropes.
Is that Saved by the Bell science?
Yeah. No, that would have been good, yeah. I mean, we could do a whole analysis of
I am
of
one of those Indian kids, you know, who...
Okay, so this was your response.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.